Welcome to Gemara Markings. Today's shiur is Yevamos Daf Tzadi Gimel. Don't forget to click on the Daf option in order to view a marked Daf Gemara for today's shiur. If you are not fully familiar with our Gemara Marking system and wish to benefit from its great rewards, it is essential that you study all of the introductory material accessed by clicking on the Learn the System option provided on the sidebar of our home page. If you are already partially familiar, you will benefit by clicking on the brief formatted introduction that is available here. Being that our system is a visual approach to the Daf Gemara, it is recommended that you print out the marked Daf Gemara before the shiur. If you wish to be in touch with us, we can be reached at gmarkings@gmail.com. Today's shiur begins 10 lines from the top of Daf Tzadi Gimel. In truth, maybe we should backtrack just a couple of lines that we already read at the end of our previous shiur, where we had made reference to the issue of Odom Makne Dover Shelo Boli Oilom. Can a person transact something that hasn't come into existence yet? So in our previous discussion, we had established that according to Rabbi Akiva, a person cannot transact something that has not come to be. And that stance is at odds with Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchok's point of view regarding Rabbi Akiva. And if you notice in our marked Gemaras, 5 lines from the top, we begin a long point. And this is a very long point because it essentially includes a very long list of rabbinic authorities that all subscribe to the idea that a person is able to transact something that hasn't come into existence yet. So if we take note of the page, you notice there are a lot of diamonds. On the side, under our Nosei Mivneh heading, we indicate that this lasts till Amud Beis. The diamonds represent Rishima Shel Amoroyim V'Tanoyim, a list of Amoroyim and Tanoyim HaSoivrim that are of the opinion Odom Makne Dovar Shelo Bali Olam. A person can transact something that has not yet come into existence. The concept in modern financial markets it reflects this idea, the concept of futures, trading in items that haven't come to be yet, that aren't on the market yet, that haven't been mined, haven't been harvested, haven't even grown yet. Can you transact things like that? So, on the heels of our previous year, it was established Rabbi Akiva is of the opinion that a person cannot transact things that haven't come to be yet. And as we said, 5 lines from the top, the Gemara says, at the beginning of our long point, Upligo Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchok. That presentation of Rabbi Akiva is at odds with Rav Nachman's version. Because according to Rav Nachman, he establishes Rabbi Akiva as holding a person is able to transact something that hasn't come into existence yet. And if you just skim down a couple of lines, you notice we have some dashed underlining. There we highlight the point that Rabbi Akiva holds Odom Makne Dover Shelobolam. But until you get to that, there's a list of names. The Omer of Nachum Bar Yitzchok, and here's the list. Rav Huna Kerav, Rav Kerabi Yanai, Rabbi Yanai Kerabi Chiyov, Rabbi Chiyov Kerabi, Rabbi Kerabi Meir, Rabbi Meir Kerabi Eliezer Ben Yankov, Rabbi Eliezer Ben Yankov Kerabi Kiva. Notice there's a chain of people leading up to Rabbi Akiva. The Omar, they will all hold like Rabbi Akiva that says Odom Makne Dovar Shelo Bali Olam. A person can transact items, or we can say a person has control over items, can dictate laws regarding items that haven't come into existence yet. And the list now is highlighted, each name, and where their opinion appears. Rav Huna, Mahi, what's Rav Huna's issue, or what's the topic in which Rav Huna's point of view of Odom Makne Dovar Shelo Bolom is reflected? The Itmar, the following is stated. Hamocher Peres Dekel L'Chavero. It's the winter season, and there are no fruit on the trees. And a person sells the fruit of the tree that will come out in the summertime. He sells that fruit now in the winter to his friend. So he's selling the fruit of the tree to his friend, the fruit that hasn't come into existence yet. Omar Rav Huna, Ad Shelo Ba'ul Olam, as long as the fruit hasn't grown yet, Yochol Lachzer Bo, they can back out from the transaction. However, mishabol leolam, once that fruit appears, ein yochol lafzer bo, you cannot back out. Now, you can't back out of what? You can't back out of a transaction that was made before they appeared. So that you see that the we see that Adam makne domer shelo bolam, a person can transact something that hasn't come into existence. And when we say you can make a kinyan, you can makne, you can make a kinyan, that is an idea that means you can't back out. So at what point does the kinyan is the kinyan, let's say, concretized? It's concretized when the fruit appears, but the kinyan itself was made. The initial transaction was made before the fruit appeared. Now we have the next couple of lines in brackets. It's only because the point of our Gemara now, we want to emphasize Rav Huna. There's another opinion, Rav Nachman Omar. Rav Nachman, he disagrees. He says, "Af mishabo le'olam yochol lafzer bo." He says that even when the fruit does appear, you can back out. Omar Rav Nachman. Modino, Rav Nachman says, "I will concede the ishomet v'yachil, if the purchaser took fruit off the trees and started eating it, lo mafkinon mine." Then we don't take it away from him. So according to Rav Nachman, even though the seller can always back out, if the buyer took the fruit off the tree and started eating it, we won't take it away from the lokeach. As we said, Rav Nachman's point of view right in this particular discussion is to be de-emphasized. Rav, now we said that Rav Huna held like Rav, that also says that Odom is a person can transact something that's lo bali olam. The Omar Rav Huna, Omar Rav. Here you see Rav Huna quoting Rav. Ha'imir l'chavero. A person says to his friend, "Soda zu shani lokeach." The field that I am planning to buy. Notice the speaker is going to buy a field, but he hasn't bought the field yet. He says, "This field that I'm going to buy, when I buy it, I want it to be sold to you right now." In other words, I'm transferring ownership of the field that I haven't bought to you. When I buy it, you will be the owner from right now. Kona. That works. So once again, you see the person is transacting something that's not even in his possession yet. Rabbi Yanai k'Rabbi Chia, Rabbi Yanai havele arisa. Rabbi Yanai had a sharecropper, someone who worked his fields, and there was an arrangement between them that Rabbi Yanai would receive a certain percentage, and the worker, the sharecropper, would receive a certain percentage. So Rabbi Yanai had an arisa to have a maisi le kansa depiri kol mali shabata. And the oris, this sharecropper, would bring a kansa, a basket of fruits, every Friday, mali shabata, every Friday. And when you receive fruits, you would then harvest, you would then tithe the fruits in order to be able to eat from them. Hahu Yoma, there was one Friday, Noga Levalosa. The sharecropper was delayed. Noga is to be, he was delayed, and he didn't come. And it seems that Rav Yanai was anticipatory of the fruits somehow, the coming later, coming on Shabbos, let us say. There is a problem, a halachic problem of tithing on Shabbos. So what did Rabbi Yanai do? Shokal eser mipiri, shokal iser mipiri de beisei olayu. Rabbi Yanai tithed from other fruits that he had in his house to exempt those fruits that he had not yet received. The sharecropper had not yet come. So in order to circumvent the problem of tithing on Shabbos, he simply tithed Erev Shabbos. He tithed on Friday. He tithed to exempt fruits that he had not yet had. That's an example of makne dovah shelo bolam. He's controlling regarding the tithes fruits that aren't even in his possession. Also, lekame de Rebbe Chiya. Rebbe Yonah came to Rebbe Chiya, and Omar Le, Rebbe Chiya said, Shapir Abdus, what you did was good. It was a good thing that you did. Desanya, the Pasuk says, Leman, and this Pasuk is in the context of tithes. It says, Leman tilmad yuras Hashem elokecho kol hayomim. And kol hayomim is Elu Shabosis v'yomim toivim. Rashi, Leman tilmad. Rashi is a little more than halfway down the Rashi commentary. Gabi truma ma'isuk siv yochaltu fnei Hashem, you shall consume them in front of Hashem. And it goes on to say what was quoted in the Gemara. And the end of the pasuk that was quoted was kol hayomim, elu yomim tovim v'shabosis. Havei lomei lizoyer shelo yivatel oinik Shabbos v'shil tikun hatevel. The pasuk is exhorting us to avoid non-enjoyment of Shabbos. In other words, one's expected to enjoy Shabbos through the food that he eats, and don't void that enjoyment b'shvil tikun hatevel because of the lack of tithing. So the pasuk is exhorting us to see to it that tithing is taken care of so that you can enjoy your food on Shabbos. Lemai hilchasa. The Gemara asks, what is the role of the pasuk? What are the circumstances that this pasuk is addressing? Ilema la'asuri umechal. If you think the pasuk is telling us to tithe before Shabbos so that you don't come to tithe on Shabbos, that couldn't be. Though that couldn't be the pshat in the pasuk, it's derech kro lemishri tiltul derabbanan. Do you need the pasuk to tell us about something that is itself mutter anyway on a Torah level? We're dealing with a pasuk, so we have to speak on a Torah level of things. Let us take a look at the Rashi. Inemo asuri b'shabbatu mechal. If you think that the pasuk is saying that you should make sure that you tithe, even if it's on Shabbos, tithe on Shabbos in order for you to be able to eat the food. If you were to think that that's what the pasuk is saying, the itzrich lashmina dafagav the Shabbos who mesaklon, that even though it's Shabbos you can do the tithing, pshita, that's obvious. Now we did mention before that one is not supposed to tithe on Shabbos. That happens to be a rabbinic prohibition. As far as the Torah level of things is concerned, there'd be nothing wrong with simply moving aside a section of fruits, declaring it a tithe in order to exempt the rest and allow you to eat the rest of them. So that, as Rashi goes on, he says, Pshita, that would be obvious. V'chi itzdrich kro l'mishri tiltu d'rabbanan. Do you think you need a pasuk to come to tell me that you can do tithing on Shabbos in order to enjoy Shabbos? Hafroshes maisis b'Shabbos ein ela mishum shvus. The prohibition of tithing on Shabbos is only a rabbinic restriction. And Rashi quotes the source, Desnan elohim mishum shvus lo magbi in shumus u'maisris maseches beitza. Where is there any precedent that the Torah prohibits the movement of something that here that the pasuk would come to allow? So if you think that the pasuk is coming to tell me that you can tithe on Shabbos in order to eat and enjoy the enjoy yourself, you don't need a pasuk to allow something that is obviously allowed in the first place. The Gemara continues at the top of Omid Beis, Ela Lav Ki Hai Gavna. Rather, the pasuk is coming to actually to encourage people to function in the way we already described, that it's mutter to tithe even to exempt fruits that have not come into your possession. for the sake of Oneg Shabbos. So this idea of functioning, of establishing a reality over something that is not yet in your possession, you need a pasuk to confirm that. So at this point, Rabbi Chiya was strengthening Rabbi Yanai, saying that you did a good thing by tithing the fruits on Friday, even before they came into your possession. Amar Lei, Rav Yanai though continues. He says, "Well, Akriun b'chalma, but I had a dream on Friday night, and in the dream I saw Kone Rotsutz. I saw a Kone Rotsutz is a shredded or crushed reed, a reed." Though when it's growing, it's whole, it is strong, but reed is made of fibers, and if it's crushed, it's rotsuts, so it's very weak and flimsy. So in my dream, I was shown this, kone rotsuts. I was shown either the words or a vision, but Rashi says kone rotsuts, mikra echad ushmoi kone rotsuts. It's a reference to a pasuk. So that's what I experienced in my dream, kone rotsuts. My lav, hachi ko amri li. Is it not so, Rav Yanai, in his worried question, says, is it not so that I was told the following, Hinei batachta loch al mishenes hakone arotzutz hazeh, where the prophet is chastising the Jewish leadership for relying on a foreign power instead of relying on the Almighty, and the foreign power was referred to as the Konerotz, it's the flim, the crushed reed. You're relying not on a solid walking stick, but on a crushed reed. So the reference to the Konerotzutz in this pasuk has a negative connotation. Hence, Rabbi Yanai, after experiencing Konerotzutz in his dream, he thought that he was receiving a message from heaven that what he did was wrong. Lo, so Rabbi Chiya tells him that's not so. That's not how to understand things. Hachi kamri loch. What you saw in your dream was another pasuk. Konerotzutz lo yishboru pishto keo lo yichabeno. Le'emes yotzi mishpat. That's the end of the pasuk. Le'emes yotzi mishpat, and Rashi quotes that, indicating that le'emes yotzi mishpat. You practiced something that was of legal truth. In other words, you did a good thing. It's simply another pasuk. We see kone rotsutz in it, and it is in the context of something positive. Hence. What you did was in fact good, and the dream that you had simply confirms that. Rebbe, the Sanya. Rebbe is another authority that holds all the makna dover shalobolom. The pasuk says, Lo saskir eved el adoinov. Literally, it's do not return a slave to his master. And what are the circumstances? Rebbe Omer, Belokeach eved. Almanas l'shachro hakosuv medaber. It's referring to a person who is purchasing a slave and stipulates that he will free him. Heichi dami. What are the circumstances or the details of that deal? Omer of Nabi Yitzchok, the kosav lei, in purchasing this slave, he writes a document stating, L'chishekochecho, harei atzmecho, kenu yoloch me'afshav. When I purchase you, mind you, he hasn't purchased him yet. It's as far as the speaker here, it's a dover shalobom. That slave is a dover shalobom. It's not in, hasn't come into his possession yet. And yet, he transacts this transaction, and it's binding, where he says, when I purchase you, I want you to be free from right now. Rabbi Meir Desnan. Now, Rabbi Meir, and where does he appear in this context of Odom Makne Dover Shalabolom? You'll note we have a framed source, and Rabbi Meir appears at the end of the source. Ha'omer Lisha, a man approaches a woman, Hareyat Mukadeshus, and he says to her, I want to marry you, Le'achar She'ez Gayer, Le'achar She'ez Gayri, after I convert, or after you convert. I mean, right now you're dealing with one of them as a Gentile, and there's no marriage between Jew and Gentile. It's a fiction of people's imagination. It's called intermarriage, mixed marriage, intermarriage that is of no legal significance. So in this case he's saying I'm marrying you after I convert, or after you convert. La'achar she'eshtachrer, la'achar she'eshtachri. This has to do with approaching a slave or a bondmaid, where he says, I'm marrying you after I am freed and become a full-fledged Jew, or after you, the lady, are freed and you become a full-fledged Jew. La'achar she'amus balech. Right now the lady in question is married, and he says, I'm marrying you. The marriage shall take place. The marriage that I'm doing right now with you shall take effect when your husband dies. Or la'achar she'tomus achosech. Right now, the speaker is married to the sister of the woman he is confronting. So he's saying, when your sister dies, namely my wife, I will marry you. Can't marry a woman and her sister at the same time. So he's proposing marriage from right now, conditional upon the death of the sister. Or li'achar she'achlots loch yivmech. A man is speaking to a woman that is bonded to a yavam, so she can't marry anyone else. So the speaker says, I am proposing to you marriage after that it should take effect after you do the chalitza with your brother-in-law. In all of these cases, the first opinion is eino mikudeshes. It is of no significance. She's not married. It doesn't work. Rabbi Meir Omer mikudeshes. Rabbi Meir says, it does work, so that even though he's offering her money right now at a time that the marriage cannot take place, but it will take a place contingent upon the fulfillment of the circumstances that allow for it. But again, he's giving the money, he's proposing marriage to her right now in anticipation of something in the future. And it works, according to Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Elezer ben Yaakov, Desanya. Yeser al Kain, Omar Rabbi Elezer ben Yaakov. Rabbi Elezer ben Yaakov is cited here in a source that's coming on the heels of a discussion, and he's presented here saying, and even further, Rabbi Elezer ben Yaakov says, Afilu im Omar, Peros Aruga Zu Tlushim, Yutruma al Peros Aruga Zu Mechubarim. We're dealing with in a source that concerns the topic of tithing, and he's declaring. As a tithe, the fruit in a particular row, peros aruga, aruga is a row, peros aruga zu tlushim, the detached fruit in this row, I'm declaring as a truma tithe al peros aruga zu mechubarim, to exempt the fruit growing in the second row that is still attached. It should be noted that fruit that's attached is technically speaking, when it's attached, it's not bound to be tithed. Oi peros arugazu mechubarim, al peros arugazu tlushim, lichshaviu shlish v'yitlishu. Another possible declaration is he says, I'm declaring the fruit that's growing in this row to be the truma, to be the tithe for the fruit that is detached, of a second row, when they grow to a third of their development and become detached. So as he is speaking, he's making a declaration concerning fruits that haven't reached this necessary level of development, a third development. Only when it reaches a third development is it subject to tithing. So at the time he is speaking in declaring the one row to be tithed, to be the tithe for the other row, when the other row hasn't yet even reached the level at which it's obligated to be tithed, it works, as we'll see. V'heviu shlish v'nitlashu, when they in fact develop to a third and become detached, Dvarav Kayomim, his declaration is binding, so that the tithe that he does now for produce that hasn't reached the obligatory stage is nevertheless a good tithing. It's effective contingent upon reaching that point in time. But once again, when he spoke, when he made his declaration, the fruit had not yet reached the necessary point, and yet his declaration was effective. So you have another example of Adam makne dover shelo balom. A person can affect the status of things that haven't even arrived yet. Rabbi Akiva Disnan. Rabbi Akiva is reflected in the following source. A woman who, generally speaking, is obligated to give over her income to her husband in exchange for the fact that her husband takes care of her. There are a number of obligations that a husband has toward his wife, and in exchange for those obligations, the woman gives over her income to the husband. And how you have a married lady saying "Koinom shani oisel lepicha koinom" is an expression that is in the realm of vows, so that she vows that that which I produce shall be prohibited to you. Eino tzorech lofer. The husband doesn't have to annul such a vow. The vow doesn't even get off the ground because the woman is duty bound beforehand, obligated beforehand to give her income to the husband. Hence, vows that abrogate that obligation have no validity, and hence the husband doesn't have to annul such a vow. Rabbi Akiva Oimer Yofer. The Rabbi Akiva says the husband should annul the vow. Shemo tadif alav yeser min aroi. When she starts producing her income, her work, she might very well produce more than that which she is obligated to give to her husband. The Mishnah Ksubas states the amounts that a woman is obligated to transfer to her husband. There is this idea of beyond the amount she's obligated, and if he doesn't annul the vow, then he in fact will be banned from benefiting from that yeser min haroi. What do we see from here, though? That if he doesn't annul the vow, the statement the woman makes concerning something that hasn't come to be yet will be binding. So a person can affect the status of things that haven't come to be yet. That's Rabbi Akiva. Before we go on in the Gemara, we have a new topic or a new old topic. Up till now, we got off the main issues of witnesses and their believability in the context of people that are going to marry a second party as a result of testimony. In order to discuss, we got off that topic in order to discuss Dover Shobolo. But now we go back to the issue concerning testimony of a singular witness concerning matters that have ramifications for marital status. On the side of the Gemara, we have a nosei mivneh heading, a topic and structural note that we combine into one. So you will see triangles and Roman numerals 1 and 2. Skim down the page to 3 lines from the bottom. You can see a Roman number 2. These represent Shnei Lishoinois, two versions, Beitziras She'ela, in the formation of a question, Be'inyan Yevoma V'Eidechad, regarding, in general terms, a Yevoma and testimony given by a singular witness. We're, in presenting the markings, we're presenting it in a very general fashion. And now, to get a little more specific, question number one, Roman numeral one, Eid Echod Hameid Shemes Baila Kadesh Tisyabim. A singular witness comes testifying about the death of a woman's husband, and this is a man that had no children, but there's a surviving brother. So the result of this testimony would be that she, the widow, would be able to do yibum. So do we accept the testimony of a singular witness that says that the lady's husband died, thereby paving the path for yibum? The Roman numeral number 2 that you see later introduces a different kind of question. Eid Echod Hamatir Yevoma Lashuk. That's a case where a singular witness offers testimony that the result of which would be that the Yavama will not be bound to the Avam. For example, a woman whose husband died, and there was a surviving brother, and the witness, the singular witness, comes and says that the surviving brother died. Well, if the surviving brother died, so the lady would be free to marry anyone she wants. Do we rely on the testimony of a singular witness for that? As we've said quite often in the last few shiurim, in halacha, in Jewish law, the testimony of one witness, generally speaking, is of no value. You need to have two witnesses. However, we've seen in the past, we've seen that in the case of what we refer to as Edus Isha, a singular witness that comes with information that a woman's husband died, enabling her to marry another man, that is that's a case, it's a situation where we do rely on what he is saying, and the woman goes ahead and marries someone else. That's of course a very superficial way of presenting the matter, but there, that's the, it's in that context that the Gemara unfolds. So now we turn to the Gemara, the triangle with Roman numeral 1, Bo Minei Rav Sheshes. The question was asked of Rav Sheshes, Eid Echod Biyavama Mahu. The witness is testifying that the woman's husband died, and he died without children. There is a surviving brother. The result of this would be that she would be able to do Yibum. Mahu, do we allow her, based on his testimony, to go ahead and marry the brother-in-law? So there are two sides of the analysis. We call that Aleph. In the next line, you see the squiggle line, O Dilma, base. So, Taima, the Eid Echad, is the reason that we rely on the singular witness. In the case of the witness who says that a woman's husband died, Mishum, the Milsa Davida Lebluye, because matters that can become revealed. In other words, if he is lying, he'll have what to lose. If the husband shows up, this witness is going to look really bad. And that is a distinct possibility, that it's testimony concerning a matter that could be revealed otherwise. So matters like that, lo mishakir, a person would not lie. If he testifies that the man is dead, it must be because he really saw him dead. Otherwise, he's taking a big chance. Say, I saw him dead when he didn't see him dead. The husband can show up making this witness look like a fool. So that when you're dealing with matters that are like that, the facts will become revealed. So people will not lie. V'hocha nami lo mishakir. So too over here, when you have the singular witness saying that the husband of this woman died, he's not going to lie. If he's claiming he's dead, it must be that he knows with assuredness that he is dead. Otherwise, he's subjecting himself to becoming revealed as a liar. Oy dilma, or possibly taimo di eid echod. The fact that we rely in these in cases of freeing a woman to marry based on the testimony of one witness claiming that the husband is dead, the reason for that acceptance or reliance is mishum de'ihi daika uminsiba. It's not that we're relying on the words, on the pure testimony of the witness, but rather coupled with what the witness says, the woman checks out very carefully before she marries someone else. You're dealing with a woman that was married. A married woman is not going to fool around. She knows there's a lot to lose, so she checks out very carefully before she marries someone else. So that's the reason in general that we would rely on the testimony of one witness, because it's coupled with her checking things out very carefully before she marries someone else. However, haha, but in this case, where her marriage isn't going to be just to anyone, the marriage is going to be to her brother-in-law. Kevon de Zimnin de Rachmole, since there are times where sister-in-laws have a great deal of affinity toward their brothers-in-law. And there's a saying that I can only paraphrase without stating exactly, is that love tends to corrupt. We have a saying in rabbinic literature of Ahava Mekalkelet Es Hashura, that but since there is this emotional element that might very well be present here of the woman having a special affinity for her brother-in-law, Lo Daiko Misuma, she's not going to check out so carefully to make sure that her husband is dead. She feels she has a little opportunity to marry the husband's brother. She'll lunge at that without checking out carefully whether her husband is really dead. So that in this case of the Yibum, there's room to raise the question, can I rely on the Eid Echad? Is the source of the Eid Echad because of Milsad Aviv, where we are really relying on the witness? Or is the power behind Eid Echad, is it because it's coupled with her checking things out carefully? And in this case, she's not going to necessarily check things out so carefully to make sure that the husband's really dead. Omar Lahu Rav Sheshes Tenisuha. We have a new marking. There's a house marking. And the house marking in this sukya, you'll see it continues on the next omen as well, are nisyonos loseis tshuvos. These represent attempts to give answers to the questions. So Rav Shesha says, Tenisua, note that it's a long answer. Omru la meis benech. And we saw this in our Mishnah. A woman was told that your son died, vahakach meis balech, and then your husband died. And if that happens, where the husband dies leaving no children, that means that this lady who's hearing this testimony is bound to Yibum. She went ahead and did Yibum. And then she was told the opposite, that first the husband died and then the child died. If that is the case, when the man died, he died leaving a child. There's no Yibum to be done. Not only is there no Yibum, but she'd be strictly forbidden to the brother-in-law, to her brother, to her husband's brother. So what is this lady to do? Tate say, she leaves the Yavam, the brother-in-law, Vahavlad, Rishon, Vahron, Mamzer, and the children that she has with the second man, with the Yavam, are Mamzerim, because you're dealing with a problem of known as Eishes Ach, the wife of one's brother. So she is strictly forbidden. And children resulting from such a union will be Mamzerim. Heichi Domi. And here we have a double underline, which we use to highlight the expressions Eleimo and then Elolav. These are stages. On the side, we have this featured, the Shlovim Levara B'mayim Adubo. These are stages in trying to figure out what really took place here. Who was communicating this information regarding the deaths? Eleimo Trey Utrey. If you are to think that two witnesses stated the first information, then a second set of two witnesses came and said the opposite, my choses de samchis ahani, what is it that you see fit to rely on the second witnesses that were restrictive, that asered, smoch ahani, rely on the first set that were matir, that allowed her to do ibum. V'od, another problem, mamzer sofik mamzeru. If it's two against two, all that we've done, we created a doubt. So it's not for sure that the children from that she has with the brother-in-law are definite mamzerim. At worst, they're suffic mamzerim. The chitema lo doc. You might say, well, it says mamzer, and he wasn't being specifically, let's say, precise. Mamzer really means suffic mamzer, but he simply wasn't being precise. The fact is that later in the Mishnah you see the following: Harishon Mamzer, V'achron Eino Mamzer. The Mishnah in a later case makes a distinction between children born before versus children born after. So you see that the Mishnah is quite sensitive to precision. Shmamina Davka Katani. So you see that the Mishnah is interested in precision. Therefore, to set up this section of the Mishnah as 2 verses 2 leads us nowhere. Elolav Shmamina Chad. Rather, we must conclude that it was one witness that appeared at the outset, indicating she was bound to the Ovam. So that's what happened in the case. One witness said that the child died, and then your husband died. And then what happened? And then two witnesses came later, switching things around. V'taima, the osu beitre akashua. And the reason that we say she must leave the Ovam is because two witnesses said that she is not bound to Yibum. Ha lav ha, he had the two reversal witnesses not shown up. Mehemon, the singular witness, would have been believed to allow her to do Yibum. Notice we have a bow tie shape, and on the side, this bow tie is going to be used throughout the sugya to highlight the word mehemon, namely ho'ed echad. The singular witness is believed. So, Rav Sheshes had been asked a question regarding eid echad biyavama, and Rav Sheshes provides us with this answer that ends at this point. Iko v'iko v'omar, another version. And you will notice in Gemara markings, when you have a presentation of something alternative, we often squiggle underline the transition expression, and that's what we've done here. V'iko d'omar ha lo tibay alach. This is not a question. The afilu ihi nami mehemna. If you're asking about an eid echad and his reliability to enable her to do Yibum, that's not a question. It's obvious that he's reliable. The woman herself is believed. This non ho'isha shomro meis bali tinose. A woman who says, my husband died, she can marry someone else if there's no Yavam. Meis bali tisyabem. Or if she says, my husband died, and there's a surviving brother of the deceased husband, tisyabem, she does Yibum. So we see that the woman herself is believed. Certainly we will be able to rely on one witness. Ki tibay alach, as we said earlier, we're introducing a second type question. The issue concerns lemishri yavama le'alma. A singular witness comes and says that the Yavam died, or the information he was telling us is that the lady's husband died, and then the child. And there is a surviving brother, but if that was the order of events, the first the husband died and then the child, there would be no Yibum, and the woman would now marry La'alma, La'almas, any some other fellow, anyone from Me'ashuk. So do we rely on Eid Echad to release a woman from a situation where otherwise I would have thought she is going to do Yibum? So again, we'll just cite one of the examples. You have a widow here, and when her husband died, he had a brother, and now a singular witness is coming and telling us that brother, the Yavam, died. With that information, she would now be able to marry someone else. Up till that point, she would have been bound to the Yavam. So do we rely on the testimony of a single witness that in effect releases a Yavama from her Yibum bond? My time of day. So in order to answer this question, we present two sides of analysis. What is the reason in general that one would rely on an Eid Echad in Eidus Isha? Mishum Demilsa David Ligli Lo Meshaker. Because things that could become revealed to the contrary, a person wouldn't lie about that. So Hochanami, so too here, when he says that the Yavam is dead, Lo Meshaker, he's not going to lie, because he knows very well that if he is lying, the Yavam himself could walk in and reveal to us that this witness who claimed he was dead is an absolute liar. So that the witness isn't going to take a chance and lie. So if he says that he's dead, he must certainly be dead. Oy Dilma, time of the Eidechad Mishum Di Daiko Mitzvah. Or, as we saw earlier, the strength, the reliance upon the singular witness in general is because the woman who's the beneficiary of that testimony will check out matters very carefully as well on her own. She daika umitsa, she checks things out very carefully before marrying someone else. But in this case, the ha lo daika umitsaba, but in this case we're dealing with the release of a yavama from the yibum bond. She's not necessarily going to check out very carefully to make sure that that brother-in-law is really dead. The misnehu, the sanyot, we're at the top of Tzadi Dalet Amud Aleph, the sanyole. There are times that there is great enmity between the brother-in-law and sister-in-law. She might hate him, and she's looking for any opportunity simply not to marry him. So he might yes be alive, and she's not going to check out very carefully to make sure that he's dead. So that's the question: is a singular witness relied upon for testimony that would release the yavama from a yibum bond, i.e., testimony stating that the yavam is dead? Omar Luhu Rav Sheshes. Again, on this omid you can see we're using the house marking where an attempt to provide an answer appears. But in addition to that, regarding this particular question, there are numerous attempts. So we've introduced an additional marking, the triangle that you see. You can see on this side under the Mivne heading. The triangle is introducing a ma'akav, an attempt to keep track of a give and take style Gemara. So with the point facing up, these are nisyonos lochiach, attempts to show that Eid Echad ne'emon lahatir yavam l'shuk, that a singular witness is believed. And we will be continuing with the use of the bow tie shape, so you can skim down the page, you can see mehemon or ne'emon in a bow tie. At that point, the Gemara is making this is drawing this conclusion that a singular witness would be believed. The inverted triangle indicates dechios. Those are rejections. Now, it is quite true that we're in the context of a daf yomi shir, but since we're in the middle of a heated discussion, it would not be beneficial to us to stop at this point, but rather to complete it, and that's going to take us down a good part of this omid of Gemara. So we are spilling over, but nevertheless, it's to our benefit. So, is a singular witness believed to matir a yavama l'shuk? So Rav Shesha says tenisua, and note this is a long answer. We saw in the Mishnah omru la meis ba'alech v'achar kach meis b'neich. A woman was told that her husband died, and then her son died, and with information like that, she would be muteres lashuk. Phoenicis, and she married some outsider. V'acharkach omru lo chiluf hoyu hadvorim, and then she was told the opposite took place. And if that is in fact the case, she would have been prohibited in marrying some other man. Teitzei vavlad rishon v'achron mamzer. Well, she's got to leave the outsider that she married, and children that she would have with him are considered mamzerim. Hechidomi, what are the circumstances? Again, the double underline are stages in trying to figure out what are the circumstances here. Ilema tre utre, if two witnesses said that she was muteres lashuk, and then that was followed by two witnesses saying that she's still bound to the avam, my choses to samchesahani. Why, if it's two against two, are you concluding that you will rely on the second set that prevent her from marrying Lashuk? Smoch Ahani, why not rely on the first two that are matir her, that allow her to marry outside? V'yoid Mamzer, Sofek Mamzer, if it's two against two, the child that's born from the outsider isn't a definite Mamzer, it's at worst a doubtful Mamzer. V'chitem olo dok, and if you try to claim that the Mishnah was not being accurate when it said Mamzer, it really means Sofek Mamzer. To claim that the Mishnah was low dog was not being precise, that's not true. Ha midikotoni seifa, from the fact that in the continuation of the Mishnah you see Ha Rishon Mamzer Vacharenu Mamzer. The Mishnah is very concerned with detail. The Mishnah is precise where it makes a distinction between the first child versus the last child. Shma mina de dafka kotoni. So we must conclude, therefore, that the Mishnah is precise and accurate. Therefore, there's something wrong by setting up this Mishnah as two against two. It would be inaccurate to say that the child with the man from the shuk that she married is a definite mamzer. Ela lav chad. Rather, the case is that a singular witness told us the information leading to her permissibility to marry Lashuk. And then what happened is two witnesses showed up contradicting that. The taima di osu beitre akushua. The reason that we say she's forbidden to the man that she married outside, the married Lashuk, and that the kid is a mamzer, is because two witnesses said she's forbidden to him. Oh, lav hachi. Had the two restrictive witnesses not appeared, mayhem on. The singular witness would have been believed to matir her lashuk. So this is Rav Sheshis's response. The Gemara, though, rejects this, and hence we have the inverted triangle. Li'oilam tre utre. It's not a case where a singular witness appears at all. So it doesn't, this source is irrelevant to our question. It's really two against two. And then you'll ask, well, if it's two against two, then why is it that we are relying on the second set? Uchidom Rav Acha bar Menyumi, b'edei hazoma, as Rav Acha says in a different context, we're talking about the realm of lying witnesses, but lying in a very specific fashion. They're called Eidei Hazoma. We'll explain that in a minute. So as Rav Acha says elsewhere, so to hear, the reason we are relying on the second set of witnesses, because we're dealing with Eidei Hazoma. Rashi explains on the top line, the Eidei Hazoma, Shachroinim, the second set of witnesses came and told us, Hezimu esarishonim v'omru. Hezimu, again, is a legal phenomenon, a legal form of testimony, where they say, Imanu heyisem. The second set of witnesses are saying, how can you say what you said? Because what you said, when you said it, in other words, the time of the events that you were testifying at, the time that you claimed the events took place and that you witnessed, you two guys were with us in a different place. And when you have a second set of witnesses countering the first set in that fashion, how can you say what you did? How can you say what you said when you in fact were with us in a different place at that time? The Torah gives believability to the second witnesses. That's what the Rashi says. The Rachmanahem knew. The Torah believes them. Kidichtiv, V'doshu ha-sheftim heitev v'nei eid sheker. V'mukminon lei b'imonu ha-yisim ma-sechas makos, in the tractate of Makos, so the sources for that are spelled out. That for us, we just take that as axiomatic, that when you're dealing with Eidei Hazoma, when the second set of witnesses are contradicting the first set with that introduction, namely, Imonu Hayisem B'mokom Ploni, you were with us at the time you're claiming the events took place, but and you were with us in a different place, the second set are believed, and hence the source said she's forbidden to the fellow that she married in the Shuk, because the information given, the information that allowed her was based on the testimony of Edim Zoymimim, lying witnesses. Omer Le Rav Mordechai the Rav Ashi, again, you see the house marking indicating that someone's going to try to answer the question. V'yami lo Rav Acho le Rav Ashi, Toshma, another source attempting to show the believability of one witness. To be matir or yavam alashuk, the source says einu isha ne'emenes lomar meis yivmi she'enose velo meiso achosi she'ekones lebeisa. There are two examples here. The first is more important for us right now, hence we've dashed underlined the word she'enose. A woman is not believed to say that my brother-in-law, to whom I was bound as a Yavama, that he's dead, and with that I can now marry Lashuk, I can marry some outsider. A woman's not believed to say that. Likewise, a woman is not believed to say that my sister, who was married to some fellow, that my sister died, and now I can marry her husband. He nihi delo mehemna. We're inferring that the woman is not believed. She is not believed. Ha aid echad mehemon, but a singular witness would be believed. So by simple drawing of inference, where the source said who is not believed, we can infer then that a singular witness would be believed. That's how Rav Mordechai wants to resolve the question. The Gemara though feels otherwise. You can see there's a long rejection. According to you that are concluding the way you did, Eimah Seifa, state the Seifa of that source. Eino ish ne'emon lomar, a man is not believed to say, meis achi shayavim es ishto. My brother died and I shall now do yibum with his wife, with the widow. Velo, a man is not believed to say, meiso ishti she'eso es achosa. My wife died, and now I can marry her sister. A person is not allowed to marry a woman and her sister, but that's when they're alive. If the man's wife dies, he then is allowed to marry her sister. Well, anyway, the source tells us that a man is not believed regarding these two examples, and we continue. Who nihu dolo mehemon? Are you going to tell me that the man is not believed? Ha aid echad mehemon. But a singular witness who would say this testimony would be believed. Bishlamo Gabi Isha. Very well, with regard to a woman where the testimony stated by a singular witness will release the woman who otherwise will have no marriage options available. Mishum iguna akilu bo rabbanon, because of iguna. Iguna, maybe you're familiar with the word aguna. This is a woman who is restrained. The word iguna also is similar to the word ogen. Ogen is an anchor. An anchor restrains a boat from moving. So a woman without this, the information provided by the singular witness, she would really be bound, either bound to the yavam or bound to her husband. And therefore, and she'd have no options, as we said. A woman, by Torah law, can be married to only one man. She can't have several husbands. So without this information, she would be an aguna. And so because of that, we have the Torah law, the halacha, is lenient and accepts the testimony of the singular witness. Elogabi ish, my iko lemeimar. as far as a man is concerned, that if a man can't marry this woman, he can marry another woman. He can marry. He has a lot of options that are open to him. So there, the svara, the logic to accept a singular witness in the case of the man, just doesn't apply. Therefore, the method of conclusion that Rav Mordechai employed in inferring that in the where the triangle appeared a few a point facing up where the source had said the woman is not believed but a singular witness would be believed, that method of reasoning is not acceptable, and hence we're not going to come to that conclusion. So now the issue is, what about the source itself? If it's not for inference purposes, what is it telling us? Elo ki itzdrich l'Rabbi Akiva itzdrich. The source that Rav Mordechai brought in is not to be learned with an inference intent, but rather learn the source for its own self, for the information contained therein. That information itself is of significance, and it's necessary in the context of the opinion of Rabbi Akiva. Now, we'll explain that. That will become clear as we go on. So the source said that the woman is not believed when she says that the Yavam, the brother-in-law, died, enabling her to marry out. So you'll ask, well, what's the significance? Like, you might say, of course she's not believed. No, it's not so simple. It's not so obvious that she's not believed, because there is a sheet of Rabbi Akiva, and what does Rabbi Akiva say? Salka daita chamina. Without the source, I would have thought. Hayul v'yomer Rabbi Akiva yesh mamzer mechayve lavin. A yavama lashuk is a woman that is bound to the yavam, and her marriage to an outsider would be the violation of a negative command. The Torah says, "Lo siya eishes ames achutzal ishzar." Lo siya, she shall not be to an ishzar, to an outsider. That's a negative command. Rabbi Akiva says that intimacy, which involves the violation of a negative command, results in children that are mamzerim. Not all opinions agree with that, but Rabbi Akiva holds that. So now you have a woman claiming that her brother-in-law died and she's not bound anymore to him and she can marry Lashuk. She would have an awful lot to lose if the brother-in-law was still alive. So I would have thought, since Rabbi Akiva says Yesh Mamzer Mechayve Lavin, Emo Chaisha Al Kilkula Vidaika, that the woman would be concerned with the mess up of producing children that are mamzerim, and as a result, she is very careful in what she says. She's checked out the situation thoroughly, and we should be able to rely on her. Chumash Malon. So the source reveals that even with that consideration, we still do not rely on her. Up to this point, though, let us emphasize that the issue of the believability of a singular witness is not to be found here. We can't derive it from the source. Rava Omar. Eid Echod Ne'emon B'Yavama Mikal V'Chomer. Rava has his approach that a singular witness should be believed, should be accepted in permitting the Yavama to marry Lashuk based on Kal V'Chomer logic. Le'isur Kores Hitarta. A woman is believed when she says, "My husband is dead." When she claims that, she's now freeing herself from a nacious ish status and going to marry someone else. Now that is a realm of that would carries with it a very severe punishment. If there are no witnesses that see her intimacy, she will be punishable by kores. And yet we believe the information that she tells us. So, correction. We believe the information provided by one witness. When one witness tells us that her husband died, and she would then marry someone else, we believe the one witness to allow to release her from an Isur Kores. Isur lav lo kol shekein. All the more so when you're dealing with a lesser type infraction, a Yevoma who would marry, let's say, wrongfully some man from the public. So that's a violation of a mere negative command. It doesn't carry with it a Kores penalty. So if we're believing the witness with information that releases her from a Kores punishment, certainly we could believe the witness in a matter that would concern only a negative command. Omerle hahu rabbonon, hahu merbonon larova. And here we have a rejection. And hence you can see again our inverted triangle. Someone said back to Rav, respond him, he atzmo tochiach, I can undo your kal v'chomer through a focus on the woman herself. De le'isur kores hitarta, le'isur lav lo hitarta. A woman is believed when she says, my husband died. And with that, with that she can then do yibum. But and that would be an Isur Kores. Le Isur Lav, but when it comes to a woman saying that the Yavam died, we saw this quoted before, when the woman herself says that my brother-in-law died, we don't believe her. So that just because there's believability in the realm of an Isur Kores, that doesn't mean that there's going to be believability in the realm of an Isur Lav. V'elo, ihi my time olo mehemno, why is it that she is not believed when she says that my brother-in-law died? The cave on the Zimna de Sanyole, since on some occasions, some cases, brothers-in-law and sister-in-law have great enmity toward one another. She might hate him. And lo daiko mitzvah, she's not going to check the matter out very carefully. She might glibly say, oh, my brother-in-law died. Might not have died. She'll say so because she doesn't want to be with him. Eid echad nami, with regard to a singular witness giving us information like that, that the Yavam died. The cave on the Zimna de Sanyole, since there are times where the sister-in-law hates the brother-in-law, lo daiko mitzvah. This explanation is based on the original analysis that we saw earlier, that the believability of one witness is coupled with the fact that the lady checks things out carefully. But in this case where it's a function of the release of a woman from Yibum through the information that her brother-in-law died, she's not going to be so careful to make sure that he's dead. She's more interested in not being bound to him because she hates him. So, therefore, the singular witness would not be believed. And now the Gemara quotes from the Mishnah, Ze Medrash Dorash Rebbe Lozer ben Masya. In the Mishnah we saw him saying, V'isha grusha me'isha, a woman is considered divorced when her husband divorces her, V'lo me'ish she'eino isha, but she's not considered a divorcee if someone that's not her husband gives her a divorce. As far as the details are concerned, you can look back in the Mishnah, but that was the drusha of Rebbe Elozer ben Masya, that a woman gains a grusha stage, which by the way makes her forbidden to kehanim, because this pasuk that was quoted, the isha grusha meisha, is in the context of kehanim. The woman is prohibited to kehanim only if she received a divorce document from someone who was an authentic husband. But if someone was not an authentic husband, so and he gave her a divorce document, she would not be prohibited to the kahuna. Omar Rav Yehuda Omar Rav. Hagalei Rabbi Elazar Lemidrash Bei Marginisa Vedorash Bei Chaspa. Rav, in looking at what we saw in the Mishnah under the name of Rabbi Elazar ben Rassis, he criticizes and says, here he had a chance to expound the pasuk as a pearl, and rather he expounded it as a shard. My Marginisa, what's the better drasha that he could have given? The Sanya, as you see in the following brisa, the same pasuk, the Isha Grusha Meisha, and what is derived from this? Afilu Lo Nizgarsha Elo Meisha. The pasuk says, now here we'll just do a literal translation, a woman who is divorced from her husband. There's room to read that pasuk in saying that she is in fact divorced only from her husband. Rashi explains, what do we mean by that? A man gave a divorce document to his wife stipulating, you are divorced from me, but you're not allowed to marry another man. Now that, by the way, is an unacceptable language, or unacceptable text in a divorce document. But let's say he did that. So that's the intention of this source, where it says, "Afilu lo nizgarsha elo meisha," even if she was divorced only from her husband, but not through his condition, not permitted, not granted a right to marry another man, psula lakuna, even though this is not an acceptable type of document, it still has ramifications with regard to her disqualification from the kuna as a divorcee. Vahainu reyachaget. This is an illustration of what we call in rabbinic literature reyachaget. It has the scent of a divorce. Even though it's not a formal divorce, it's nevertheless enough to render her disqualified from the kahuna, the post-sale b'kuna, renders her unfit to marry a kohen. Before we conclude, let us remind you that if you wish to be in touch with us in order to access marked gemaras, we can be reached at gmarkings@gmail.com. With that, we conclude our shiur for today.